Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of The Daily Friend Wrap. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined again this week by Herman. Today's stories, we're going to be talking a little bit of a follow-up to yesterday's story about the head of the South African military going to meet with Iranian officials. We're also going to be talking about a new campaign being launched by the IRR about moral fraud. And we're going to be speaking about Maponya Mall and some drama that's happened around there in Soweto, which says a lot about the problems in South Africa. So, for those who didn't listen to yesterday's show, basically the chief of the South African military, General Rudzadi Mpawanya, went off to Iran and appears to have had some kind of, I don't know what to describe it as, other than sort of a bit of a love fest with the military of Iran, which, shall we say, the context right now is a really bad idea, considering that we've got strained relations with the US, which remains one of our largest trading partners, although who knows if that's going to continue with the tariff barriers. But the point being that this was ill-timed and weird, and we criticized the decision very heavily. However, after that show was recorded, the Ministry of International Relations and Cooperation, a very silly name, but anyway, it's the name of the ministry, put out a statement saying essentially that the general had done this of his own accord, that he doesn't set policy, that his statements about South Africa's foreign policy goals should not be considered authoritative, and that this was confirmed by a statement from the Ministry of Defense and Military Veterans, which said, the ministry wishes to clarify that matters of South Africa's foreign policy and international relations are the sole prerogative of the President and Department of International Relations and Cooperation. The Department of Defense and Military Veterans does not make political or policy decisions on international relations. It is unfortunate that political and policy statements were reportedly made during the meeting between General Rudzadi Mpawanya, Chief of the South African National Defense Force, and the Iran Defense Force leadership. The Department of Defense reiterates that only the President and DERCO determine South Africa's national policy on international relations. The Minister of Defense and Military Veterans will be engaging with General Mpawanya on his return. Interesting. So either the government realized that this was a huge error and has now thrown the general under the bus, to make it say like make it seem as though he essentially went rogue and was doing something unsanctioned, which, if true, would be a sign that the government is continuing to blunder and doesn't really have proper control of itself, or, which does seem more likely to me, the general has an agenda of his own, and he thought that it would be wise to make these statements. He went off and was rogue, and he said things that were not in accordance with government policy. Now, Herman, I think that one of the important things that separates South Africa from many countries in Africa is that the military does not have a role to play in our politics. This is a very important line that we should hold, because otherwise you can become like Zimbabwe, which is essentially ruled by the military. All successful countries maintain this very strict line where the military is kept out of politics. This seems to me like an offense for which the general should be fired by government. And in fact, I don't think there should be much debate over it. But am I wrong? What's your take on the story?
No, you are absolutely right. And the saving grace of South Africa might be the fact that we have this separation between politics and the military. But I think part of it also is that mercifully we have a useless military. If we compare our military forces, and I'm not talking about, you know, actual members of the armed forces. I've met some of them. I know some of them. They are genuinely good people there. But we are talking about top leadership and management, where,
maintenance,
for example, I know some horror stories about people who had to audit military assets, and then there would be this multi-million rand missile technology that they need to find because it's on the asset register, and sort of it's part of securing that the assets are actually checked, and then they sort of have to search for it, and they find it somewhere out in a field, in a shed, rusted next to some gardening equipment. So there's a level at which the competence or incompetence of our military might be our saving grace, in the sense that before any political interests capture the military to use it as an oppressive tool, it'll have to build up the military in and of itself, which might be an overall value add exercise in our sort of state structure. But what we do have here is either, as you say, an ANC with a zero geopolitical judgment, or we have an ANC that is frankly losing control. And we might even have a bit of both, where the general was sort of led with a wink and a nudge. Yes, you know, say these things, carry over this message. And it is even possible that what he said out loud was supposed to be implied, supposed to be nudged at and winked at.
Right. If you read ANC internal discussions and documents and things not said on the official level, but what the general said is pretty much in line with what the ANC does believe about how the world works.
Exactly. And I think what we see here is just another example of CADA deployment coming back and biting itself, you know, in the buttocks. Because a merit-based appointee in such a sensitive position, at such a sensitive time, would understand the implications of what they say. And this is something that I think goes throughout history. The best generals have had a sense of context, a sense of understanding, a sense of patriotism, and are almost always less flashy than one would imagine them to be, as sort of these cowboys. So judging by this behavior.
In the World War II context, you'd compare Douglas MacArthur, who was the flashy showboat, you know, I tell the civilians what to do, not the other way around, kind of general. And he ended up being fired by President Truman because he was basically going rogue. And then Eisenhower, who eventually became U.S. president, but before then was much more in the background, sort of even keel, keeping people on the same page, doing his job. And I think that's one of the reasons why he ended up having a successful career and impact on the U.S., whereas MacArthur ended his career in sort of infamy.
Exactly. So if we look at this purely from a meritorious perspective, this is clearly a military leader that doesn't cut the mustard. So it is completely feasible that he is a cadre, that he buys into the ANC's mythology of the world, that he was possibly even led to or encouraged to make these statements in an unofficial capacity. But even to that extent that he was clearly being an idiot, he was being an idiotic idiot in the sense that he didn't have the presence of mind to understand that not only is he shafting his country, he might be actually shafting his political party. So whatever the case may be, it is a reflection of just a collapse of competence and frankly another national embarrassment for which, mercifully, I think most South Africans don't feel embarrassed by. But the ANC has this weird addiction to its own prestige. And it is, despite everything, quite sensitive to criticism, not sensitive to rational counter-argument, sensitive to criticism of its esteem. And I wonder if this might even be a bridge too far for them, that this is bringing the president of the ANC, who also happens to be the president of the Republic, into disrepute. This moral superpower nonsense. I mean, versus this.
Yeah, no, exactly right. It's just kind of, it's whatever the true story is behind here, the only explanations are bad. It's clear. I think that you cannot have a position where a general is saying things like this just simply because it demonstrates that he clearly doesn't understand the position that he's in, that he could make statements like this to begin with. And engaging with the general upon his return is not sufficient sanction. No. You need to fire him.
And that's quite important. one thing that I think is also quite sad about the current state of sort of African strongman politics is there is this weird charged atmosphere about sticking it to the West and rejecting, you know, Western overtures and American overtures. I couldn't help looking at that footage and those photos of this event and thinking, my word, I don't think I've seen something as imperialist as this in quite a while. Africa might very well be, you know, in this century, the territory for another contest of loyalty between, you know, your sort of American European interests and your Sino-Russian interests. But we are deluding ourselves if we think that being owned by the one side is sort of saving us from the indignity of being owned by the other. There was something quite cheap and patronizing and paternalistic about the Iranians receiving this African general who, you know, we've got what, three or four Harrier jets, half a submarine and a pea shooter.
Hey, don't knock out Gripen jets, okay? They're not that bad.
They're just Gripens, not Harriers.
But yes, no, exactly right. Like it is, you know, at least the West will pay for your HIV medication and, you know, give you tariff free access to their markets. At least they used to. but anyway,
if out of white guilt, then nothing else. But you know, there'll be some sort of transaction.
No, exactly. So yeah. Anyway, let's move on to our next topic. Herman, the Institute of Race Relations put out a press statement today. That being us, as job crisis persists, South African churches must help end, quote, moral fraud of fake transformation. Can you tell us a little bit about what the idea here is?
So what has become very clear is that the transformation debate is shifting. BEE has never been under this much pressure. I think its proponents have never been on the defensive to this extent. We've never seen the ANC release statements to say, oh, by the way, we're affirming our policies thus. Thank you for your attention. And this is what they've been doing over the last few weeks, particularly this last week or two. We saw statements along the lines of, we just want to let everyone know that nothing has changed. We still stick to our policies. And that is usually the sign of worry, nervousness, or pressure. But beyond the fact of transformation shifting away from, you're against transformation or you're either for transformation, there's the reality that you get real transformation, which uplifts, which empowers, which is non-racial, which is pro-growth, which creates jobs, or fake transformation, which has landed us here, where you've got massive inequality between the richest Black South Africans being the politically connected elite, poorest Black South Africans who really just want to escape the socioeconomic exclusionary legacy of apartheid, but have been denied that right. So the question of real versus fake transformation is actually where the debate has now moved to. And part of that debate is a moral component. It isn't enough for fake transformation to be criticized for its economic failures. That in and of itself should disqualify it, but we should be honest that political debates have a moral component. Apartheid wasn't just economically stupid. It was immoral. It wasn't just immoral. It was economically stupid. And the same thinking can be applied to fake transformation in the sense that it is destroying investment, the investment case for South Africa. It is destroying value-add economic incentives. It is destroying our social support structures, our infrastructure. On all the data points, it is failing. But what we need to understand is that if we want to turn this around, we are going to have to address the moral side of it. And that is why we wrote to the South African Council of Churches yesterday, inviting them to engage with us on this further, speaking about our Blueprint for Growth policies and inviting them to meet with us so that we can share our polling data, so that we can share our economic analysis and make the point that if you are a moral actor within this sphere, as the South African churches undoubtedly are in a majority Christian country, then you have to get real about pastorally what you can do to alleviate the suffering of the communities you claim to love, to cherish, to nurture, and to be in service of. So we'll keep everyone updated on the responses we get. But over the next few months, we are going to deliberately go after the moral component of faith transformation. It isn't good enough just to win the debate. It's about hearts and minds. And I'm quite excited to see what our opponents can come up with in terms of an answer to the moral fraud of faith transformation. If South African churches have a proud history of opposing apartheid, of playing a positive sociological role, well, here's the opportunity to dust off those credentials and show us you care.
No, I think that's a great idea because, you know, we are a very deep religious country, even though I think in our sort of more elite media, that's generally not actually represented particularly well. And yet, you know, after being so involved in many positive ways during the fight against apartheid, I do feel like the churches really kind of haven't stepped up. They've either sort of kind of helped the ANC in some cases, or they've just sort of sat on the sidelines and tinkered around the edges. They've been concerned about, you know, the more amorphous concepts. Oh, it's a problem with violence, or there's a problem with sexual assault, or there's something.
Or greed.
You know, you need to, right, that's not gripping the problem properly. And as you say, you know, if you want to be a strong moral actor in society and genuinely sort of see the things that you believe in actually kind of come to pass, you need to kind of engage seriously. And I think this is a really great angle that we are taking. So,
and part of that is also that the South African Council of Churches are more than welcome to tell us to get stuffed. But right. Then at least they must be honest about the fact that they have now fully retreated to the kingdom spiritual. That's fine. But then we shouldn't hear from them social commentary.
Right.
Their sort of any form of social activism. They're free to do that. I hope they don't. I hope we get positive engagement and construction on the moral fraud component. But let's see where this goes, and we'll try extending the moral case from this position.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. Okay, let's talk about our last story. And this is one of those sort of example stories which I think kind of shows really how state failure on multiple occasions has created a crisis. So Maponya Mall in Soweto was today forced to shut down because local residents were blocking roads following an attack on e-hailing drivers that left one dead and two injured. Residents of Maponya Mall burned tires and blocked the road outside the mall. Quoted by News 24, one of the people attending the protest said, "We heard two shots first. It's become so common that we didn't even react immediately. Then my son peeked through the window and told me that cars were being set on fire. Later, we saw a woman who had been shot in the cheek stumble near our gate." She said that the gunfire and the sight of these injured people had traumatized her family. And she then went on to say, "That was the final straw for all of us. We phoned for help, but we were so shocked. We feel that if we can't use the mall for good purposes, let it not function." So, Herman, we were discussing this in the pre-show chat, but basically what happened here is government failed to provide transportation opportunities for people. So this created a vacuum which got filled by taxis, which eventually over time became mafiaized monopolies, associations that acted more like sort of gangsters or unions than they did like sort of true businesses. When they faced competition from e-hailing, they responded with violence. And now the community, frustrated firstly by just the chaos in their environment, a thing that many poorer South Africans in particular are very angry about all the time, I think, justifiably so, they have responded not by saying, oh, you know, the police must do this or we must call the police or there must be more funding in the police, but by protesting violently to block the road and cause destruction and shut down an economically active thing, because they believe that this is the only thing that's actually going to draw attention to it. And considering this is now in the media and is getting, you know, sort of responses from police departments and stuff, maybe they actually have a point in a weird and twisted way. I don't know, Amanda, what's your take on this story?
In July 2023, in tracking the election campaign and the issues at play, I saw an uptick in the heat surrounding the issue of crime. And it was weird because there wasn't an obvious trigger on the surface level. It took me quite some time to figure out what was driving this increased chatter online and in news media on crime. And at the end of the day, my conclusion was that it was civil unrest in Diepsloot and Diepkloof. And reading some of the best reporting and journalism that I've read in a long time was the reporting coming from the ground in these unrests, where this sort of firsthand horror of seeing people hacked to death, burned to death, shot, where the trauma has become almost blasé. And what was palpable in analyzing these crime stories as they sort of flowed through the month of July specifically was the anger at two sources, at government and at the criminals. We often, I think, come to the conclusion that townships are violent places because the people of townships are violent people, when in reality, the people of townships are mostly vulnerable, sharing an unattended, lawless, orderless space with violent and vile people. So I can't be surprised by the irrationality of this response, because imagine what it must be like to be that vulnerable, that isolated, that forgotten. The state doesn't give a crap about you. You know that. The mafiosi in the various, you know, water tanker mafias or the taxi mafias or the construction mafias or the zamazamas, they are a fact of life. They plague your community. They aren't rumors. They sweep through your streets. And then...
Right, you either are paying them to avoid trouble or you're avoiding them to avoid trouble.
And then when nothing works and everything starts burning, I sort of can understand the violent, self-defeatist, fatalist psychosis of saying, fine, we'll burn it all down. And as you say, perversely, we're talking about them where we weren't a few days ago. Government is making promises where they weren't making promises a few days ago. But in looking at what happened in Diepsloot and Diepkloof in July 2023, by the way, which was the culmination of stuff that had been building since May, sort of, it is difficult for middle class, you know, suburban inhabitants to understand that these flares up of violence can last months, and you can sort of have calmer times and escalating times, but they can last such a long time. And looking into the anger as to why these people were angry at government is to go back and look at statements and speeches made by government officials a year prior, 2 years prior, seeing Becky Cele make promises of, no, we'll have a rapid response SWAT team stationed in the township. We'll have Gaspers, you know, everywhere on this street corner. We'll have 220 specialized units and all people deployed here. Only for it not to happen. Or to the extent that it does happen, it doesn't work because In one case, they weren't supported by the local police. In another case, the national police didn't, or the police didn't want to work with the local safety forum. So at the end of the day, the chaos that's behind here, as you said at the beginning, it is failure cascading down and rippling out. And what makes it so sad, so truly sad, is that it's getting to the point where even the economic argument doesn't purchase it, any foothold, because it's the Wild West out there, that the government and the concept of law and order ceases when, you know, when the suburbs sort of conveniently roll back in your rearview mirror as you drive out. How we fix this, I mean, God only knows. I when it comes to the issues of law and order, I tend to be a bit fatalist, possibly because I don't understand the system well enough. But just to have thought through this experience of how it must be, I mean, it really just depressed me.
And justifiably so. You know, this chaos is a thing that millions of South Africans live with every day, and it, you know, makes their lives difficult and sometimes takes their lives. And it's, you know, I think that the reality is that there are so many components to this. You know, there's the economic angle. There's the fact that when people see violence all around them, it kind of lowers the barrier for other people to commit violence because it just becomes sort of accepted. It's, you know, people don't have money. The police don't work. They don't have other opportunities. There's hundreds of these factors that all kind of play into this one. From a sort of governance and policy perspective, I think the first thing really to do is just get the police trusted again. And to do that, you probably have to create special units that can, you know, investigate corruption and get rid of corrupt or poorly performing police. You need to have proper standards, fire people who don't do their job. And then you need to just slowly do the basics of policing, earn trust back from the community, follow through, investigate crimes, put people in jail, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. If you do that basic step, you will begin to roll back the problem. This is a decades long problem to solve, but that's where it starts.
And I think we might have enough time to do that with a combination of domestic and foreign skills. We still have people like Glynis Breytenbach. We still have people like Billy Hofmeyr. We still have, you know, people who saw the system to the extent that it stood, saw its potential for becoming, you know, a democratic entity of a new constitutional settlement. It's very ironic that the South African Police Force changed the name to the South African Police Service because they wanted to emphasize the serving component. The problem is the label has changed, but the substance has remained the same. So I do believe that with the right leadership over the next 5 to 10 years, it's enough academic practitioner skills will be retained in our private sector and our retirees from the police. I'm reading a book now by a leading criminological profiler, Gerard Lavskagni. We've still got these skills. But it won't be enough. Three things will need to be added to this skills potential. Number one, the political will to see it through. Number two, the resources to afford it, because it's not going to come cheap. And number three, the willingness to actually look to countries in the world that have achieved drastic law and order turnarounds that have been sustainable and constitutional. I'm not talking El Salvador. I'm talking New York 1970s, 80s. I'm talking, you know, Toronto around the early 90s. You know, really when the slum culture became a criminal entity. We can look to India. Japan has never really had crime because I guess we can't really import a ton of Japanese people. But we will have to be intellectually humble and say, look, world, give us your best and, you know, don't give up on South Africa yet. It's sort of a sentimental pitch, but my word, short of those things falling into place, this type of destructive toxicity, criminality, ickiness really just becomes depressingly stubborn to remove.
I think that's right. All right. Well, on that note, let's call it to a close for today. Thank you very much for listening, everyone. Yeah, on that hopeful note, let's call it to a close there. I think you know, just to put that, it is hopeful in the sense that, you know, I think there is a sort of fatalism amongst some South Africans that this just can't be fixed. That's just how things are and how they always will be. But that's not true. These things can be fixed if we make the right choices. And that's something we must never lose sight of, is the right choices in policy and performance and holding people accountable, all those things. We will get the society we want.
Fatalism.
Not there yet.
Fatalism is a self-fulfilling prophecy.
100%. And that's something that one should never fall into. Okay. Well, thank you very much, everyone. We hope you enjoyed the show, or at least found it interesting, even if it's not enjoyable per se. We shall see you tomorrow on The Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone.
The Daily Friend Show and The Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR. Or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.